Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome, everybody. It's Sunday. It's a live edition of The Main Course, unless it's a repeat in the future. I'm Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, Bushwick, Brooklyn. We're produced and engineered by Joe Galarraga. Joe, are you there? Are you awake?
I'm awake.
I've not bored you too much. Well, are you prepared for Hurricane Sandy, the Frankenstorm?
I've been trying to stock up on all the canned stuff, and my mom and my dad have both called me telling me I need to, you know, buy bottled water and all these things, but I don't know. Last year, there was supposed to be Irene, I guess, and it
failed.
I made a big hoopla about it.
But you only have to have one big storm really screw you, and then you'll remember forever. I mean, in olden times, people used to get screwed by weather all the time. I think it was just a regular part of civilization. It's just that on any given day, you were like, oh, so-and-so didn't come into work or, you know, couldn't deliver his feed because there was a massive storm. And I'm actually a little worried about it because, you know, I have power that runs my refrigerators, both at the meat shop, at the Essex Street meat shop, and here right around the corner from Roberta's. So, I mean, if the power goes out, that's not good for a refrigerator full of, you know, fresh meats.
Yeah,
you can imagine. Well, it'll be interesting, Joe, and I know you're going to be one of the first people looking at this. There's about to be a major hurricane that, you know, is going to sweep through New York, and they say go as far as Ohio, which is really unusual this late in the year, this far north. I mean, it just shows that there is obviously a global warming phenomenon. I'm really aware of global warming because I live, like if you live in Florida or LA, maybe it's harder to notice. But, you know, in New York City, I haven't been able to go, not that I've been trying to go sledding, but you can't go sledding anymore. I mean, you used to, as a kid, I would go 10 times a winter, 10, 12 times a winter. That doesn't happen anymore. Even if I wanted to go sledding, there's oftentimes just not enough snow on the ground. Or, you know, there'll be a tremendous blizzard once, and it'll be the worst blizzard in 20 years, but that's it, you know, for the whole season. So I do think there is global warming, but it'll be interesting. I mean, I touch wood that this doesn't happen, but if there is flooding in upstate New York and all these family farms end up kind of getting screwed by the flood, I'll be interested to see which news organizations cover it. And we're considered a food radio station. We're probably going to cover it almost on every show. I really do think that. There'll be certain shows that concentrate on it more than others, like The Main Course, The Farm Report, A Straight No Chaser, but even I bet the Snacky Tunes guys and all those guys will mention it. Now, let's look, and it'll be interesting. And again, I hope this doesn't happen, but if it does, if there is flooding and New York State farms get screwed, it'd be interesting. Will the New York Times food section have a single article about it this year? I predict not. Does the Food Channel even have a show to cover such things? And let's say it doesn't even cover that all these farms get screwed by drought or whatever, just the facts. They don't have to piss off their sponsors or anything, but just the facts. I mean, they don't even have a news show for it. They actually don't even have a cultural anthropological show about the history of South American cuisines and things like that, like an intellectual show. There's basically what we're saying is not 30 minutes of serious food content have ever hit the TV waves of the Food Channel. Definitely not the New York Times food section. You're going to have to go to the business section and other sections to learn about the effect of the floods. Will Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, will any of these organizations say, hey, there's an ecological, a farm side of food? There's not just the food and the chef and the chefs of the year. There's actually the eco component to gastronomy. You know, eco-gastronomy, Carlo Pacini was here for a decade ago, talking about eco-gastronomy, and everyone's like, oh, yes, absolutely, 100%. Where's the eco? I mean, literally, I'm not saying that there's not enough eco. I'm saying the two organizations I just mentioned, especially the Food Channel, I mean, there's never been a minute of serious content in 20 years. I just think that's so outrageous. Anyway, well, like I say, I do hope the hurricane doesn't hit. I saw Cloud Atlas. Joe, did you see Cloud Atlas yet?
I have not.
It's about recycled souls. You know, souls kind of revisiting each other throughout history. And it is interesting because, you know, how are you going to act in your life? You know, and what are you going to do? I mean, it kind of makes the case that our destinies are entwined and your life is not just your life. It's part of many other lives throughout history in the past and the present, but also in the future. So, you know, we're doing our part. I'm always proud to say Heritage Foods USA has no written contracts with anybody except our insurance company. Everything else is based off handshake agreements. I think that's pretty cool. So here we are. We're in studio with the very bored Jacques Gauthier, who's just like, Jesus, you have me come in and I have to listen to you babble on forever. But Jacques is a good friend. I've known him for, I think, over 10 years. And he is, of course, the very successful chef of not one but two restaurants, Palo Santo and Fort Reno, both of which exist on the same street, Union, between 4th and 5th Avenues.
I live there, too.
And he lives there, too. So three great gastronomic zones, his kitchen and then the two restaurants. Anyway, welcome into the studio, Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
Your wife and lovely son are just outside listening
right
in.
Outside.
Also bored, but now they're getting less bored. So it's very interesting. I mean, you're a little restaurant on a tree-lined street producing mostly South American food or influence food. And now you've opened a barbecue place, which I'm sure also has a South American something to it, since that's so interesting to you. And it's also on this tree-lined.
It's pretty much just classic
barbecue.
You know, people ask us, what style of barbecue? So it's Brooklyn style barbecue. You know,
that's there's always always
mix
counts
of different influences.
So where do you fit within the chef category of New York City? I mean, you see, you know, there's famous, there's the Batalis of the world, and then there's the street cart vendors. I mean, the high, low, up, down, no hierarchy. I'm just saying, where do you fit in? Because you're kind of an anomaly.
One thing that's funny that I've seen in my career, it's kind of taken a turn. I still cook sometimes in the kitchen. Last night I was working on the line, but I don't do quite as much cooking as I thought I'd be doing when I first started my career as a chef. I think that a lot of those, you know, the Mario Batali's and other, you know, big name chefs, they have a lot of people behind them. They have people who do their books. They have people who, you know, do their maintenance on their restaurants. And I have two small restaurants, and I basically do all of my own work, you know, the behind the scenes work. You know, I spent the last few days, last week or so, doing a renovation of the basement at Fort Reno. We've retiled the whole basement. And that's, you know, me and a few guys who I hire to do it.
You know? How do you know how to do that stuff?
You know, just kind of learn through doing it. You know, I built both restaurants, and it definitely, Palo Santo took me a lot longer to build. It took me about a year and a half. And then Fort Reno took me about 4 months to build. So, you know, I've learned in the doing, you know, lots of watching YouTube videos, how to do this.
So do you hire someone to come in and be your main person, or are you the one going to get the wood and the nails and drills and all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do a lot of that. And then actually, my sous chef at Palo Santo, he's super handy. He has been with the restaurant since before we opened. He worked on the construction with me, and then I kind of, you know, just started teaching him how to cook.
Is he from South America? Big guy?
He's from Mexico. Not so big, you know, thick but short. And so he's pretty handy. And him and I together did the whole build out at Fort Reno. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
So where do you fit in? I mean, because a lot of chefs would say that, I mean, yeah, it's an unusual position because you do everything yourself and you have a team, obviously. But yeah, you don't have a tremendous amount of money behind you. You're not part of a brand. I mean, these are just two kind of restaurants of passion for you, and you're prepared to do everything.
Yeah, two places I've put together. And a lot of people still, I mean, most people still think of me as a chef. That's still kind of the public identity I have. But really, I've become more of a restaurateur. You know, I'm more of like, you know, making sure everything works out, you know, keeping the books straight and, you know, keeping up with repairs. And
doesn't your mom help you with that? Do I see her sometimes coming out of your apartment with like a bunch of pieces of paper flying all over?
Yeah, before she retired, she was a CPA, and so she does a lot of my accounting and bookkeeping.
Now, where does your restaurant fall into the general trajectory of restaurants in New York City? Because the menus are different. I mean, certainly Palo Santo is a South American restaurant, right?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to speak about all of New York City when we have such a unique and special restaurant scene here in Brooklyn. I think that we are, you know, really among our own when you talk about Brooklyn restaurants more so than large Manhattan restaurants.
So. But South American, so describe the cuisine. I mean, it is your influence. You lived down in, where was it, Central America?
I've traveled a lot. My father's from the Caribbean, from Haiti, and family spread out in Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic. But I've traveled a lot, you know, in South America. I spent a little bit of time working at a winery in Argentina. And when I came up with Palo Santo, it was... in a lot of ways, a reflection of my travels and of my upbringing, being an American with parents. You know, my mother's from the States, my father's from the Caribbean, and having traveled so much, it was really a reflection of my upbringing and, you know, the culture that I had that was a mix of cultures.
So, what's the menu, for instance? You would call it Pan American?
It was labeled as Pan-Latin pretty early on at the Times. We kind of tried to come up with our own category of eclectic Latin or Latin market cooking, because that's really what we do. It's influenced by the cooking that's done in markets in Latin America.
So what are those ingredients that are different from those of the U.S., for instance?
Well, one thing...
Poblano peppers.
Poblano peppers, yeah. One thing...
yucca?
That definitely use a lot of yucca. And I would say one, speaking of proteins, one thing that definitely also, you know, this month we have more of is goat. Goat's something that is we've always had on our menu since the beginning. This week we actually have a West Indian style curried goat on our menu. We made with coconut milk, and it's kind of spicy. And goat for us is a very staple protein, and it always has been because it is in a lot of Latin America.
No, yeah, we're going to definitely get to goat. Is it true, my friend Renato Sardo, who is lives out in Italy and has a company called Baia Pasta, he said that where the environment is more abundant, like for instance rainforests, and things are just lush and abundant, basically biodiverse and abundant, that the cuisine suffers. And I went down to Costa Rica, for instance, and we love the fruit drinks we have, but we didn't find the ingredients or the, you know, the chickens and the cuisine actually that sophisticated or delicious. I mean, it was hard to find good food there. Is that something you found as well?
I've never seen that correlation. It's something that I've thought about a lot. Why is food perceivably, you know, it's hard to say this in a PC manner, but how is food perceivably better in some countries compared to others? I've never seen biodiversity negatively affect that. I would say that I could give you another example of Peru. Peru is actually even more diverse than Costa Rica because they have everything from it's called alpine tundra, right? When the mountains are so high that it snows all year round and there's no trees, they have part of Peru is on the Pacific coast. They have coastal deserts. They have lush rainforest in the eastern side. And Peru has an excellent cuisine. And I would accredit that more to the pre-Columbian culture that existed before colonization. And then the mix of that with Spanish and other influences. I think that in other places like Costa Rica didn't have Machu Picchu or other very established civilizations. And so I think that's why places like Mexico and Peru that had the Mayas, the Incas, the Aztecs have a more developed, interesting cuisine with different sauces and a wider variety of ingredients.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because there's not particularly good Mexican food here either. I mean, Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel says that North-South exchanges do not happen as often as East-West ones.
Yeah.
Is that true with South America, Central America, North America? I mean, is there...
It
hasn't come here. South America cuisine just doesn't exist here very much. Even Mexican cuisine is not good. People complain. There's not a single good Mexican restaurant in New York. I mean, yeah. That might be changing within the past couple of years, but that's amazing to me. I mean, we have French, 5,000 French bistros here and an Italian restaurant probably in every block in all five boroughs. Greek coffee shops even with the souvlaki. And yet, what's up with the...
Look at the amount of time that the Mexicans have really been a prevalent part of our city. The Italians have... there have been a lot of Italians here since... when the 20s or even before, and Italy has great food. The Italians have brought that here. I think that the Mexicans are starting to bring that here. If you look at census data from around 2000, or even before that, 1990 or so, the Mexicans in the 90s, the Mexicans were the fifth largest Latin population in New York City, and now I believe they're the largest. So the Latin populations in New York City in the 90s were from largest to fifth largest Puerto Rican, Dominican, Ecuadorian, Colombian, and then Mexican fifth. So if there were not a lot of Mexicans here, that would explain why there were not a lot of Mexican restaurants.
Right.
That's changed a lot, and now the Mexican population is the largest of the Latin populations, and I think they're seeing a lot more good Mexican food. If you go down to Sunset Park, if you go out onto Roosevelt Avenue in Queens, you do see it.
Yeah, there is... there is starting to be... Well, of course, the restaurant industry is ironically run by Mexicans, I mean, particularly from the Puebla region, right? And yet, that is interesting, though. I mean, in L.A., that has very good Mexican food. And yeah, maybe it is just an idea of time. I mean, with time, there'll be more of these restaurants opening.
I think so, definitely. One thing that's interesting is that there is a lot of good Mexican food cooked in New York. It just, if the Mexicans are not necessarily running the restaurants and deciding what goes on the menu, they're there cooking the food, but then they're making Mexican food when they feed the staff or in their homes. When I opened up Palo Santo, one thing that also was part of my concept for the place was after working at so many different restaurants in New York, I knew pretty much that it was basically the fact was that if you were looking for a kitchen staff, you were most likely going to hire Latinos. Probably Mexicans, Ecuadorians, or whoever else. Those are the people who do the cooking in the restaurants. So one thing that besides my own cultural, ethnic background, I also thought that if Mexicans are the ones doing the cooking, wouldn't it be interesting to bring in some Mexican influence into the cooking that we did in order to, encourage our cooks to feel more of an attachment to the food?
Mm-hmm, for sure, for sure. So now, is goat a big ingredient in South America? I mean, I know it's the most commonly eaten protein in the world, but, I mean, are there goats running around everywhere? Well,
definitely. And I think even more so in the Caribbean. Most of the Caribbean islands are very mountainous. Some of them, are covered with jungle. Some of them have been deforested, but... in a mountainous area, cows don't do so well. Cows like nice
pigs
lush.
Don't.
Yeah, pigs.
Mountains.
And pigs. Also and the heat too. I don't think pigs do great in the heat, more diseases and stuff like that. But goats are just so well adapted to a mountainous terrain, and so I think that's one reason why the Caribbean has a lot of goats.
And but they end up making basic. And this is how most Americans understand goat. I mean, they make these braises, these stews, these strong kind of things, oxtail. I mean, it is not a refined cuisine. I don't know why that is, but I mean, that would support, the islands. You have fish, you have abundance, you have fruits growing on every tree. And guess what? The food's not that great. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's just an idea. But, I mean, how come goat has not been more popular here? I mean, Is it because that island preparation of goat just isn't appealing to the North American palate?
I don't know. Maybe they just haven't been introduced to it. I think
you that, don't do that with those, though. I mean, the goats, were you making soups out of them, or were you serving them in different ways?
Well, like I said, this week we were cooking goat in a green curry, which, you know, like a West Indian style green curry with coconut milk. So that is a very rich, flavorful, spicy braise that is typical of, I don't know, maybe Jamaica or Trinidad and Tobago and other West Indian countries.
And then, now you've been bringing in goats every week for the past 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's for Goat-tober, of course, which I'm sure our listeners know. It's about helping dairy farms find an outlet for their unwanted male goats. Because while you can try to milk a male goat, you definitely don't want to eat what comes out. So, what do you do? I mean, you bring in these whole goats. What happens? I mean, really, tell us step by step, because it's fascinating. No one's ever talked about this on any show anywhere. So,
well, we butcher them. Some of the goats have been coming from upstate. We used one of those, the kind of odd bits from it. We used when we made tacos for a local food event, the Let Us Eat Local, the Just Food annual event.
What do you mean, the kidneys, the hearts, things like that?
Well, mostly the head. Yeah, the head more than anything else. And when we got it in, we butchered it and took the head and cooked it down by just boiling it with beer, water, and mirepoix, carrots, onions, celery. Some bay leaves and peppercorns, and
just you just boil it for down. How long?
It slow boil, like a slow simmer for it was at least like 6 hours or so. Peeled the meat off the head, and then saved the stock to do something else with, to make a braise or something, and then peeled the meat off of the head, the brains, the eyes, all everything edible. Chopped it up. Mixed it with some chili powder, you know, ground chilies and a little ground cinnamon and ground cumin, and then fried that in a frying pan with a little bit of oil or lard, and put it in a taco.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, that's the cheapest meal in the world. I mean, a goat head would probably sell for. Probably give it to you for free or sell it to you for 50 cents a pound.
It comes with the goat, so you got to use it somehow.
Yeah,
you know?
Mirepoix is very little. And then, yeah, it's just the tacos, which do you make yourself?
Yeah, we make the tortillas. We make the tortillas
corn.
Corn. You get instant cornmeal and maseca or something like that.
Do you get pissed when people offer you flour? And how come they don't use corn tortillas for quesadillas?
It's almost always
flour.
We do. I think that type of quesadilla is more traditional of like kind of Tex-Mex cuisine.
I see.
Whereas the cuisine in kind of the heart of Mexico, in Puebla or in Mexico City, quesadilla is usually made with one fresh corn tortilla that's folded over, as opposed to two of them stacked on top of each other.
I see. Very interesting. So, and then what else do you do? So that's the head, but then, I mean, when you get it, how do you break it down? I mean, if someone were to, because it is the cheapest way to eat, someone brings in a whole goat from their local farm and they take it home, what do they do?
Well, we get the whole goat in. We start by taking off the extremities, you know, take the head off, and then take the neck off. When we cut into that, careful to cut in between the vertebrae so as not to get splinters of bone. You could actually do it with a very small knife. Sometimes when I teach a new cook how to butcher, I have them do it with a paring knife, with a very small knife, so that they don't have the brute force of a cleaver, just the kind of precision of a small knife, and then they learn the anatomy. Butchering, I think the most important thing about butchering is learning the anatomy and where the bones are. Take the neck off, and then the legs come off, just right, and you know, pull the bones out of their sockets, cut the meat and the tendons and ligaments and connective tissue away from the bones, and then the bones just come right out of their sockets. So you have the legs off, you have the head and the neck off, and at that point you just have the ribs, the belly, the ribs, the loins, the backbone. And at that point, you can either keep going with a little knife or use a cleaver if it's easier, and remove the spine. So you're cutting on both sides of the spine. You're cutting in between the loin. Careful not to lose any of the loin, because that's the most valuable meat. Mm-hmm. And the spine comes off clean because you've cut the ribs where they attach to the spine one by one. You've gone through there. Then you have the loins attached to the ribs and the belly flap. Cut off the belly flap. This is where you do need to break some bones to do this. So you're breaking the bones to separate the belly flap from the ribs.
But so you're just breaking those very thin little rib bones, which you could do with, you know, almost your hand hitting the top of the knife kind of thing.
Yep. I mean, if it's a young goat like the ones we've been getting, they're super tender and the bones are not really, really strong. So we're just, yeah, exactly. Put a heavy butcher knife on top of the bone and hit the back of the knife and it'll go through the bone. Or use a cleaver if you want a little bit more weight. Yeah. Then with the goat chops, and that's really the most valuable, most prized part of the goat or of any animal is the loin and the chops. So cut in between each rib. And you'll have a chop attached to a rib, and just in between each rib, you cut down, and you've got all these beautiful little goat chops.
Hmm. Very interesting. And have the customers been open to eating goat? I mean, I know some of the chefs are like, it's a pain in the ass to push. No one wants goat. Like, you know, Balthazar, for instance, people don't go there looking for goat at all. No. You know, and so it's a challenge for them to do, although they managed to do it. I mean, how about your clientele?
See, that's never been our experience. Having a Latin American restaurant, goat really fits in well with our cuisine. Mm-hmm. We've had it on our, this whole month, we've had it on our prefix, which $27 three-course prefix, an appetizer, a main course, and a dessert. And we've had the goat on that prefix at Palo Santo all month. And
how much the prefix really, cost at Palo Santo?
$27 for a three-course.
$27. Yeah. That's outrageous. No, just kidding. Everyone is like, you know, if a poor black kid is like, hey, I spent $800 for a Jay-Z ticket, everyone's like, good for you. You should do that. And then if you're like, if that kid is like, you know, I was asked if I wanted to spend $19 for a turkey, everyone's like, that's outrageous. How could you? $19. Come on. That's elitist. Yeah. It is really outrageous how ridiculously food is judged differently than any other thing. I mean, I've never seen activists go and protest in front of an Armani store being like, this is an expensive version of a shirt. How dare you produce an expensive version of a shirt? You know, it's just a shirt. And, you know, also what it does is it totally ignores quality.
Yeah.
That there's qualitative differences between a commodity turkey and one raised on a small farm.
Yeah.
It presumes those are the same. And if they were the same, then of course you could get pissed off at the farmer for trying to charge you $7 a pound for something. But it is outrageous. And I actually said, you know, it is a little, well, it's definitely classist. It's almost a little racist to say that food's elitist. It presumes that poor people don't have taste buds. You know, and cannot distinguish between, you know, something raised in Smithfield and, you know, something raised in Good Shepherd Ranch.
Yeah, that's something really, really unfortunate. And I think that in, you know, to go back to Mexico and Peru and other places that have a traditional cuisine that's really interesting and well-developed and good, I think that poor people eat, they may not always have the money to buy a lot of ingredients, but they're eating well because they know how to cook, and so they can buy cheaper ingredients like a goat head, mm-hmm. or, you know, goat head and some corn to make some tortillas is not that expensive. So, you know, maybe when the goat gets cut up, the rich person's eating the loins and the poor person's eating the head and the, you know, the pig's feet and, you know, whatever else, but they can be equally delicious if you have an open mind. And that's kind of the way that we've approached Latin cuisine at Palo Santo.
Well, it was, yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, barbecue used to be it was interesting. We had Jessica Harris here, does a show, and apparently she tells this story about once the slaves were released, you know, through the Emancipation Proclamation, which I think happened like 1863, the landowner came back to his former slaves and, you know, were like, hey, you know, would you help me clean out my barn? You know, and I'll give you some of the, you know, chitlins and skin and lesser cuts, you know, in return, which of course they were very good at making good with barbecue. And the slave, former slave, responded, well, no, sir, now, you know, we're free and we eat high on the hog.
Yeah.
And high on the hog, that's where that started. I always thought high that was interesting. Hog, yeah.
Oh, and the pig standing up the loins of the top part of
it. Yeah, that. Exactly. That's as high as it gets. Anyway, we will take a break and come back with Jacques Cotier, the chef and owner of Palo Santo in Fort Reno here in Brooklyn.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
So we have 8 more minutes with Jacques from Palo Santo and Fort Reno. So we're talking about holidays.
Holidays are coming up.
Now, Thanksgiving is a big day. You think I want to hear your theories on Thanksgiving. And, of course, we're talking about Central America. The turkey, of course, is from Central America.
It is, in fact.
Yeah. So tell us, I mean, are people eating out on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, when we first opened up almost 7 years ago, we were not open for Thanksgiving. But now Thanksgiving at Palo Santo has become a big deal. It's our second busiest day of the year.
Really?
I think only topped by New Year's. It's right up there. Last year it beat Valentine's Day. And Thanksgiving is becoming more and more of a restaurant holiday. More people are taking the whole family out, going out to eat at a restaurant. This year, we're at Palo Santo. We're offering Thanksgiving at our place, and then at Fort Reno is Thanksgiving to go. So, selling whole smoked heritage turkeys to go from Fort Reno.
What a pain in the ass that is for the chefs. I mean, it must be so difficult because you can only fit so many birds in the oven at one time, right? I mean, these are massive, 16-pound. I mean, it's so hard. So what is the menu at Palo Santo? What's it cost?
At Palo Santo, $60 per person for a four-course menu. And we have, in addition to turkey, we also have some game and fish and vegetarian options. But turkey is definitely the, center stage. Two different preparations that people could choose from. The white meat, we roast, brine and roast, and serve it with more traditional American, stuffing and chutneys and stuff like that. And then what I think is actually the most interesting thing that we do on Thanksgiving is we take the turkey legs and braise them in a sauce, in a mole poblano sauce, which is a Mexican sauce made with chocolate and chilies and nuts and a ton of other ingredients. And a lot of people think of that as being done with chicken, but turkey and other game birds are maybe even more equally popular or more popular than chicken traditionally made in mole.
Game birds being pheasant?
There's one called guajolote, And guajolote is kind of like, I don't
guajolote.
Know. Guajolote is kind
Could
of
you
like
tag a, that one, Joe? Guajolote.
It's like a, it's kind of like a wild turkey, like and that's why, that's one reason why I like the heritage turkeys, because they are closer to that type of game bird.
Guajolote. What about ducks and geese?
Yeah, those are good too.
I like to call the Toulouse goose the ribeye in the sky. That's actually not my line. I earned that from Steven, the chef of Farmstead. But man, that is so classic. The ribeye of the sky. How is waterfowl? I mean, is that big down there? Waterfowl is an interesting subcategory of birds.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think that they're not as popular in Mexico as chicken, turkey, and some other, you know, land-dwelling game birds. But we definitely use those. I think we got some geese, was it last Christmas or the Christmas before, and put them on our Christmas Eve menu.
Hmm. Yeah, the Christmas goose, I mean, that's a kind of forgotten tradition, right? I mean, in Charles Dickens and stuff, you'd always see him, or Scrooge, you'd always see the little kid like running to the store and getting a goose, which apparently was the poor man's food. It was like the poor people got geese and the richer people got meatier birds, because I guess the goose just doesn't have very much meat on a lot of parts of it, right?
Not as much as a duck. That's been my limited experience with geese. I've been that, yeah, they're a little bit gamier than ducks, and a little bit leaner, and also just, you know, a little bit skinnier. Yeah.
A famous, I'm sure you've heard this about the duck that goes into the bar. He's like, do you have any grapes? And bartender's like, we don't have grapes. We're not a farmer's market. We're a bar. Get the hell out. So the duck leaves and comes back. He's like, do you have any grapes? He's like, oh, you were just in here. Get the hell out. We do not have grapes. So duck leaves. He comes back a third time. He's like, do you have any grapes? And the bartender's like, if you ask that stupid question one more time, I'm going to nail your feet to the bar. Duck's like, you don't have to get like that. He comes back a minute later. He's like, do you have any nails? And bartender's like, no. He's like, do you have any grapes? he just wanted to know that one thing. So now I know the Barclays Center just opened.
Yeah,
Is that a hoopla? Like, are local businesses being like, oh, are we going to get more business? Is it going to have an effect on us? Either traffic or parking or reservations.
It seems like we're just a little bit too far to see any of that business yet.
Although you're less than a mile, but you're far by New York terms.
Yeah, exactly. One subway stop, about eight blocks. we've seen at Palo Santo, we've seen no change in business when there have been, you know, the Jay-Z concerts or other events there. Whereas at Fort Reno, we see a little bit of a push before and after. But I think where they're seeing the most business are some of those newer restaurants and some of the older pre-existing restaurants that were on Flatbush Avenue, just visible from the stadium.
Yeah, for sure. It is. It's funny how you said that. In the city, distance is different as the crow flies versus reality. Mm-hmm. So tell us, is there a dish at Fort Reno and a dish at Palo Santo that have never changed since the opening of the restaurant?
At Fort Reno, we basically have our set menu with four items on it: chicken, St. Louis ribs, and the whole pig pulled pork and brisket. And those four basically stay there. We've had specials. I think that the whole pig pulled pork is definitely the top seller. That's definitely the most popular and what we sell the most of. Ribs are pretty popular too. And then, you know, this month we've had goat. We stewed it, smoked it, few different ways. And that's been moving pretty well. Not anywhere near as much as the whole hog, but definitely it's been good.
Cool. And Palo Santo, is there an unchanging dish? Like, it's just so popular that you can't take it off?
The menu at Palo Santo changes a lot more than the menu at Fort Reno. We change the menu every day, but there are a few things that tend to stay. There's one favorite also, you know, to talk about cooking whole pigs. We get in whole pigs, break them down into quarters, and then cook them overnight in the oven. Just kind of like, you know, a slow roasting overnight, pull it out the next day, take all the bones out, pull the meat, add some vinegar, a little bit of hot pepper, and salt, and then put them into trays where they kind of set and cool them down overnight, and then the next day, so it's like a, you know, basically like a 3-day preparation. The next day, we cut them into cubes, and they're, you know, they hold together, and heat them up in the oven, and then as soon as somebody just kind of, you know, breaks into them, it all falls apart, and we serve those sometimes, you know, with different sauces. Last night we were serving it with a beer gravy, just like a beer and molasses reduction poured over top of the pig with a little bit of the crispy skin on top.
Very interesting. Well, and you have a website, palosanto.com?
Palosanto.us.
.us.
Yeah, palosanto.us.
Getting the Pan-American thing going on that. Well, that is excellent. Well, thank you so much for being a guest. We're going to talk about slaughterhouses in the next weeks and turkeys. And, you know, it's the Earth's Bounty comes out the most, certainly when it really comes to seasonal meats.
Yep.
So, well, thanks so much. And
my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you on. And, you know, Ann and I are big fans of your restaurant. So, again, yeah, thanks for being on. And Joe, good job engineering. I hope you got the tag spelled correctly.
Wahalote.
Wahalote. There we go. All right, bud. Well, thanks so much. And Straight No Chaser is next. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.